The problem is that the WHO functions on a weird mid-20th century axis where it considers any regulatory system outside of Europe, Canada, and the United States to be suspect automatically. So the process of certifying these vaccines to apply billions of dollars of donor funds to buy them is incredibly complex, and they've been waiting in line for months, despite Western vaccines just sort of breezing through the queue at the WHO. This is a really unfair structural problem that needs to be fixed. The African Union ordered 300 million doses of the Sputnik vaccine. That's actually going to cover 20% of the most vulnerable people in all low-income countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And it's an incredible, incredible step towards gaining access to the vaccine and exiting the pandemic for the poorest countries on Earth. But now, the organizations like the WHO, the COVAX facility, and Gavi have to recognize that these vaccines exist, that there are more vaccines coming out, and help them to get out into the world rather than hinder them.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Absolutely key points that you are raising on this day of action. Achal Prabhula is the Access IPSA project in Bangalore, India, of that group. And Fatima Hassan is founder of Health Justice Initiative in Cape Town, South Africa. That does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Gazdar, Libby Rainey, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman with
This is KBOO Portland.
Hello, my friends. This is Life During Wartime.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, March 17th at 10 p.m. for Life During Wartime.
Not just a regular Life During Wartime, playing punk and hardcore, having live bands, and letting you know all the underground DIY punk happenings going on in the Portland metro area.
Just because we're different, they have a spaz attack.
This is a celebration marathon. It's from 10 p.m. to 5:30 a.m. It's our 26th year on the air, so we're having a 25th anniversary celebration.
Looking back at the DJs and bands
Life During Wartime
that have made Life During Wartime a punk institution in Portland, at KBOO, and on the World Wide Web.
Celebrate 25 years of Life During Wartime by donating during our anniversary marathon celebration.
On Wednesday, March 17th, from 10 p.m. to 5:30 a.m.
Here on your community radio station.
KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an Oregon utilities company faces lawsuits over catastrophic wildfires. Governor Kate Brown's considering early release for prison inmates who helped crews battling those fires. And Portland police reach a settlement in the wrongful death lawsuit from the family of a black teenager. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 11, 2021. I'm Annette Newell. Thank you so much for joining us. One of the Northwest's largest private utilities faces a pair of lawsuits over allegations of negligence related to last year's catastrophic Labor Day wildfires. The two major action cases against PacifiCorp are on behalf of 100 victims of the Beechey Creek or Santiam wildfires that destroyed more than 193,000 acres east of Salem. With several communities destroyed, the blazes also killed five people. The plaintiffs are seeking more than $1 billion for lost homes, property, and businesses. They claim PacifiCorp failed to safely design, operate, and maintain power lines that were responsible for the blazes. They say the utility company failed to heed National Weather Service warnings about the powerful east winds that have historically contributed to wildfire spread in Oregon, including the Beechey Creek fire. Edelson PC and Johnson Johnson Lucas and Middleton filed the lawsuits. The law firms say that grouping the suits together gives wildfire survivors a better chance at fair compensation. This is familiar territory for Edelson PC, which has represented more than 1,000 people in a case over the Northern California campfire, which killed 85 people back in 2018. The law firm says it plans to file more lawsuits against PacifiCorp, citing similarities between the Beechey Creek fire and the California campfire that could have helped prevent the massive damage Oregon suffered last summer. Victims say they had no warning of the approaching fires and that if power had been shut off, much of the devastation could have been avoided. Pacific Corps has declined to comment on the lawsuits. Some of the heroes of the wildfires were actually prison inmates who fought the flames. Now, as KBOO's Jeffrey Wade reports, they may get a reward for their efforts.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown is considering the early release for prison inmates who assisted crews in battling wildfires that scorched massive areas of the state last summer. Considerations will be made concerning trimming the sentences of inmates, according to Brown's office, as a reward for serving the state in a time of crisis. Brown spokeswoman Elizabeth Maris said in an email this week, quote, "The governor believes that these adults in custody should be acknowledged for their contribution to this historic firefighting response," end quote. For those to be considered for early release, inmates must have worked the 2020 wildfire system, had a record of good conduct for the last 12 months, have a housing plan for post-prison life, and do not pose an ongoing threat to society. At this time, it remains unclear how many people are going to be eligible under Brown's parameters, though for some, a lessened sentence of up to 12 months may be likely. The Department of Corrections alerted district attorneys on Wednesday that Brown's proposal may include some inmates convicted of, quote, person-to-person crimes, and has advised a complete review of those who participated in the wildfire fighting effort. This could include people serving time under Measure 11, the state's mandatory minimum sentencing law. The review process for potential individuals will extend through mid to late April, with the deadline for prosecutors to object to an inmate's release set for March 18th. For those approved by the governor's plan, early release will not be until after May 6th. Over the last year, Brown has expanded the necessary criteria for early inmate release due to concerns regarding the coronavirus pandemic. Mira maintains that Brown's plans to address inmates aiding fire crews is not part of that effort and is a one-time potential reduction. Critics of Brown's proposal say it's bad public policy, and the lessening of inmate sentences undermines due process and consequence, diminishing community safety. Regarding the early release considerations, Washington County District Attorney Kevin Barton said, quote, "They had their day in court, and they should serve their time. And when they have done that, then they can join the rest of us in the community, but not beforehand." With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
A wrongful death lawsuit from the family of a black teenager killed by Portland police in 2017 has resulted in a settlement, with city council members apologizing directly to his family. Quanis Hayes was only 17 years old when police shot him three times with AR-15 rifles on February 9, 2017, outside a Northeast Portland home. He was on his knees when he was killed, with his arms raised in compliance with officers' orders. Officer Andrew Hurst shot Hayes after cornering him in a driveway, following reports of armed carjackings in the neighborhood. Hayes was not armed when Hurst shot him, though a replica gun was found nearby. Hayes' family filed lawsuits against both the city and Hurst in 2018, saying the officer's use of deadly force was unreasonable and unjustifiable. A Multnomah County grand jury did not charge Hurst for Hayes' death in late March 2017, ruling that the shooting was justified. On Wednesday, the city agreed to pay $1.5 million to the Hayes family, as well as almost $600,000 in legal fees and additional costs. The agreement says the city admits no wrongdoing, but city commissioners apologized to members of Hayes' family. Commissioner Joanne Hardesty said, "I genuinely hope this settlement provides some level of relief." Yet she added, "But let me be clear, what is happening today is not about justice or accountability. This decision does nothing to fix our broken system." Additional apologies came from Commissioners Carmen Rubio and Mingus Mapps, as well as Mayor Ted Wheeler. The Hayes family says they are ready to put the incident to rest despite being devastated about the loss. Grandmother Donna Hayes summed up the family's grief, saying, "There is no amount of money that can bring him back. I will always have this pain in my heart." A third-degree murder charge is reinstated in the case against a former Minneapolis police officer, Derek Chauvin. Chauvin killed George Floyd in May of 2020 after kneeling on his neck for 9 minutes. For more in this story, we go to Georgia Fort with Racial Reckoning, the Arc of Justice.
The Minnesota Supreme Court ruled it will not weigh in on the decision to reinstate a third-degree murder charge against Derek Chauvin. Judge Cahill made the announcement during jury selection Wednesday.
It appears that the Supreme Court has denied review of the defendant's petition for review of the Court of Appeals opinion. I think we still have the jurisdictional issue with the Court of Appeals.
Judge Cahill scheduled a hearing Thursday morning to discuss next steps on the reinstatement of third-degree murder charges. As of Wednesday evening, five people have been confirmed to sit on the jury. A total of 14 will be selected, including two alternates. The trial still on track to begin March 29th. Also on Wednesday, members of the Minnesota Coalition for Police Accountability called for public support of eight bills to overhaul policing across the state. Jelani Hussein, director of CARE Minnesota, said the world is watching.
We have to talk about what is happening not only inside this courtroom, but outside the courtroom. And outside the courtroom, we have created policies that have allowed police officers to work above the law.
According to the coalition, thousands of complaints have been made against Minneapolis police officers in recent years, but only 20 of those complaints resulted in disciplinary action. The bills include proposals to end qualified immunity and police-only responses to mental health crisis calls. You can find out more information at mncoalition.org. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Georgia Fort.
Today, the Oregon Health Authority reports 367 new confirmed and presumptive COVID-19 cases and 11 deaths. This raises the state's death toll linked to the virus to 2,316. Oregon has now confirmed more than 158,000 COVID-19 infections. COVID-19 hospitalizations are at 121, one fewer than yesterday. On the vaccinations front, there are now more than 445,000 people in Oregon who are fully vaccinated against COVID. More than 788,000 in the state have gotten at least one shot. To go along with the pandemic, we're also suffering from the dangers of an infodemic, according to an expert in Washington State who studies the spread of disinformation on social networks. Professor Carl Bergstrom with the University of Washington explained this week how long histories of racism and medical mistrust, along with a lack of trusted messengers, have paved the way for COVID-19 misinformation and vaccine skepticism.
I've worked on respiratory viruses for a long time, and we've been worried about something like this happening. We've known it was only a matter of time, and in 2020, our luck finally ran out. The COVID pandemic obviously upended all of our lives. And we've all had to become epidemiologists because we've had to understand what's happening in order to plan, in order to keep ourselves and our families safe, in order to understand the world that we live in now. We began with this enormous scientific uncertainty about a virus that had never been in humans at all before December 2019. And that created this uncertainty vacuum where we didn't have we don't have scientific answers to anything. What's the infection fatality rate? How fast does it spread? Is it airborne? Can you transmit it before you have symptoms? When it started, we didn't know any of those answers. And so it created this enormous uncertainty vacuum that everybody had to deal with, including scientists. And into that uncertainty vacuum came flowing a whole bunch of things. We had organized disinformation campaigns like the ones that were presented early on in a year ago, February, with rumors about sulfur dioxide blooms over Wuhan, indicating that hundreds of thousands of bodies were being cremated and things like that. We had disingenuous government messaging, like Trump and Kudlow saying, oh, this is, February 26th, a year ago, this was all going to go away, we've got it contained, et cetera. We've had all of these fake studies and astroturfing. So examples of, well-organized, polished studies that are put online trying to make it look like this is one that's saying that claiming that hydrochloroquine was extremely effective and had been covered up by the medical establishment. We had a change in the culture of how we communicated among scientists. Everyone wanted to work very rapidly. We didn't have time to go through the usual peer review system before sharing results with one another in the sciences. And so we started to rely very heavily on preprints that hadn't been peer reviewed. Unfortunately, some of them were absolutely dreadful. This one claimed that the HIV genome had been inserted parts of the HIV genome had been inserted into the coronavirus, and this was indicated that this was a manufactured bioweapon. It was completely false. It was taken down after 2 days, but in the 2 days that it was up, it became one of the most ever covered articles in the history of the Altmetrics article coverage system. We've seen equally dreadful peer-reviewed work. We've got a paper where people are actually claiming that 5G, you know, proposing a mechanism, a completely nonsensical mechanism for how 5G could create viruses within your body. We have a paper in The Lancet that turned out to be fraudulent that led to the cancellation of a large number of hydrochloroquine trials. So we've had that problem. We've had organized agnotogenesis. And agnotogenesis is the strategy of deliberately creating uncertainty or doubt around a topic. It's the same strategy we've seen from big tobacco, from big oil. Now we've seen it from, you know, those opposed to non-pharmaceutical interventions. So we've got people trying to raise enough doubt about the science, not necessarily to change people's minds entirely, but to stave off regulation, right? We've had sloppy reporting, headlines that contradict their own stories. This one, they're talking about how the headline suggests that this new lab study indicates that the virus will be far less effective. That's not at all what it says. It doesn't even test the efficacy of the virus. We have got people that are treating the crisis as a career opportunity and pushing themselves to the forefront as sort of pundits and talkers. We get cherry picking of different anecdotes and studies by, you know, if you're by the, you know, anti-mask side, we'll cherry pick their studies. The pro-mask side may cherry pick their studies and so on. And all of this is all wrapped up in the authority of numbers, which are particularly difficult for us to challenge because they seem to come straight from nature. Numbers seem to have this almost divine authority. They're facts. That, you know, not opinions, right? And that's not really right. The thing is, few of us have the training to see through that kind of quantitative misinformation. Accept that there's a lot of uncertainty, acknowledge this uncertainty, and recognize that, you know, early on in a pandemic, if somebody is giving you a certain answer, that person is probably not speaking for the scientific community. Don't be intimidated by numbers. Don't use numbers to intimidate people. This is one of the main things I've been working on for the last few years is talking about how we can develop an understanding of quantitative information without having a professional background in statistics or in the sciences or anything like that, just by thinking clearly about what numbers are and what numbers mean. Beware of the information landscape that we're in. Beware of the issues that I talked about at the start, all of the sources of disinformation and misinformation that can come flooding into the information environment around us. Weigh each study in the context of the entire literature. So each study does not hold up a new fact that eradicates everything that was written before it. Each study is, in the, you know, very memorable phrase of my colleague Natalie Dean, a pebble on the scale of one hypothesis or another. And I'd like to see that explained much more clearly to the public, who sometimes feels like they're getting whiplash, sort of just like the, you know, red wine, is it good for you, is it bad for you? They feel the same kind of COVID whiplash. Oh, I don't trust any scientists because last week they said these escape variants were bad. Now they say it's no big deal. They don't know what they're talking about. And if this was presented as a pebble on the scale, that would leave people in a very different frame in terms of how they think about what it is that we do as scientists. Of course, we treat each paper as it comes in as that pebble on the scale.
That's Professor Carl Bergstrom with the University of Washington. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on debunking COVID-19. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 8, Soul Connection. At 10 o'clock, Radio Lost and Found. Tonight's weather, clear to partly cloudy skies, the low down to a chilly 35. Tomorrow's weather, sunny and up to 60, much like we saw today. We could see some rain this weekend with highs in the high 50s. And today in history, today we'll actually make history because we've lost a pioneer in the radio business. Lou Ottens, the Dutch inventor of the cassette tape, has died at the age of 94 in the Netherlands. He's described as an extraordinary man who loved technology. About 100 billion cassette tapes have been sold around the world. The quote of the day is from the inventor himself, Lou Ottens, who often credited his team for his work. He said, quote, "I have no pride dial." President Biden signed the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill a day earlier than planned and ahead of his speech tonight, marking a year since the pandemic started. It's one of the largest spending bills in American history. The White House says $1,400 checks to many Americans could start hitting bank accounts by this weekend. With more, here's today's edition of 2021 Talks.
I'm going in primetime to address the American people and talk about what we've been through as a nation this past year. But more importantly, I'm going to talk about what comes next.
President Joe Biden's address tonight marks 1 year since the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic. He'll lay out the next phase of the response, including a vaccine push, authorizing the purchase of an additional 100 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson single-shot vaccine. When the president speaks tonight, he'll have a big accomplishment to tout.
The motion is adopted.
The House of Representatives gave final approval to the nearly $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan, one of the biggest spending bills since the Great Depression. The Senate confirmed Merrick B. Garland as Attorney General, Marsha Fudge as Secretary of the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and Michael Regan to head the EPA. Meanwhile, the Biden administration's foreign policy is taking shape. Secretary of State Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan, President Biden's national security advisor, will hold the administration's first in-person diplomatic meeting with China next week. Secretary Blinken testified Wednesday before the House Foreign Affairs Committee.
This is an important opportunity for us to lay out in very frank terms the many concerns that we have with Beijing's actions and behavior that are challenging the security, prosperity, and the values of the United States and our partners and allies.
Roberta Jacobson, a top White House advisor on border issues, told a White House press conference Central American youth can now apply to join parents already in the U.S.
Today we are announcing the restarting of the Central American Minors Program for children to be reunited with a parent who is legally in the United States.
First, the administration will process the nearly 3,000 children approved to travel here before former President Donald Trump ended the program in 2017. Jacobson acknowledged border crossings have spiked, including unaccompanied children. She says they're trying to share legal ways to immigrate and deter those from entering illegally.
You cannot come through irregular means. It's dangerous, and the majority of people will be sent out of the United States.
A civil rights group has filed suit against Iowa's new voting reform law, which reduces early voting from 29 days to 20, among other restrictions. Joe Enriquez Henry, with the Iowa League of United Latin American Citizens, is convinced the changes were made for reasons other than election integrity.
It is not voter security. It is voter suppression. It is making it harder for us to utilize our right to vote.
Former President Trump requested a mail-in ballot for an upcoming local election in Palm Beach, Florida. Despite harshly criticizing the practice, Trump acknowledged Florida's system is secure. Mike Moen contributed reporting. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum.
It's been a year since the U.S. declared the official start of the pandemic. It's brought a lot of hardship to children. And families have struggled, many getting some help from school food distribution programs. So how are children faring now? Suzanne Potter takes a look.
1 year into the pandemic, California is ranked the nation's 20th best state for children, according to a new report from the nonprofit Save the Children. Researchers looked at the data on how many families experience hunger or poverty or lack the tools for remote learning. Will Detmar, California State Director for Save the Children, says the data on hunger is troubling.
One out of five California households are reporting that they do not have enough food for their kids to eat. That's 2.1 million kids in the Golden State.
The report found that 10% of California families say they don't have the right tools to get all their kids on Zoom classes every day. 50% say they're having trouble paying bills, a number that goes up to 65% for Black and Latino families. Tamara Sandberg is U.S. Food Security and Nutrition Advisor for Save the Children. She says the pandemic has really widened the income gap for families of color.
These families are twice as likely as white families to lack enough food. They're twice as likely to be struggling with housing costs, and they're about 1.5 times as likely to have difficulty paying bills.
The new COVID stimulus bill contains provisions designed to cut the childhood poverty rate in half. And the new Golden State stimulus, approved in February, provides direct relief to low-income families and struggling businesses and puts millions into state-subsidized child care. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The hardship of the COVID-19 pandemic is especially tough on our Native communities. Here are some comments about that from Dr. Anthony Fauci, who serves as the chief medical advisor to President Biden.
The rate of hospitalizations per 100,000 population among Native Americans is multifold higher than that of whites. The rate of death per 100,000 population, death due to COVID-19, is in fact multifold higher among Native Americans. And for that reason, it's so important to get vaccines to the Native American population, and when the vaccine becomes available, to get as many of your individuals in the tribal nation vaccinated as you possibly can, as quickly as you can. It's so important to get vaccines to the Native American population, and when the vaccine becomes available, to get as many of your individuals in the tribal nation vaccinated as you possibly can, as quickly as you can, because it's a highly efficacious and very safe vaccine. So I just wanted to get the opportunity to tell people in the Native American community why it's so important for their own health, for that of their family, and for that of their community to get vaccinated when vaccines become available. The community spirit among the tribal nations are such that when you have something that you realize is important for your health, for that of your family, and for that of your community, I know it's a close-knit community. So perhaps that's one of the reasons why, when something as life-saving as a vaccine comes along, the uptake of it is very smooth and very efficient. So in that respect, I think the rest of the country might learn a lesson from how things have gone with the tribal nations.
Dr. Anthony Fauci also said today that the answer to get us back to normality is a blend of aggressive vaccine implementation and a gradual easing of restrictions. Native educators say representation matters in high levels of government, as the nation appears on track to approve a Native woman for a high-level job in the Biden cabinet. And casinos are planning to open for Navajo people with limits on capacity. With those stories more, here's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily report dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
Congress approved the $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill Wednesday. With House passage, the American Rescue Plan is off to the president's desk to sign. Nationwide, the bill provides $1,400 stimulus checks, mounts a national vaccination program, extends unemployment insurance, and reopens schools. Investments in Indian country include housing assistance, resources for language preservation, and Indian education relief funds. The president is set to speak Thursday about moving the nation forward in a primetime speech. Native people are encouraged by Deb Haaland to see what impact she'll have, as she's likely to be the next Secretary of the Interior. Many are closely watching her confirmation process play out. A leader of a national Native organization is hopeful, as Roz Brown reports.
Native American educators say tribal representation at the highest levels of government will likely encourage more civic engagement and trust in the government. If New Mexico Representative Deb Haaland is approved for the position of Interior Secretary, she would become the nation's first Native American cabinet secretary and oversee the Bureau of Indian Education. Cheryl Crazy Bull, president of the Denver-based American Indian College Fund, says only about 20% of 18 to 24-year-old Native American students are enrolled in college, compared with 41% of the overall U.S. population. She says it's time they see themselves more broadly represented.
So I view having a Native person in that Secretary of Interior role as just vital to being able to develop better education.
The latest data shows that only 16% of Native Americans attain a bachelor's degree or higher, and only 9% attain associate degrees. Crazy Bull says the case can be made for a system that is more responsive to the specific needs of Native students.
Education in tribal communities is really about upholding identity. So her policies and practice around land and resource use, sacred site, all of those things will impact the education environment for our communities.
In addition to the Bureau of Indian Education, Indian Affairs, the Department of Interior under Haaland would oversee about 500 million acres of public land and federal policies affecting the 574 federally recognized tribal governments. This is Roz Brown.
The Navajo Nation is implementing a soft reopening as COVID-19 cases decline and vaccinations continue. On Wednesday, a new public health order was issued, bringing the Navajo Nation down from red status to orange. Revised guidelines include a safer at-home order, daily curfews from 9 to 5, and updated provisions for businesses and gatherings. Most businesses will be allowed to open at a 25% capacity, including casinos in Arizona and New Mexico, which had been closed since March of 2020. Dr. Jill Jim, Navajo Department of Health Director, spoke about the new plans during a special town hall Wednesday night.
Navajo casinos are allowed to open to the Navajo Nation residents and employees only. So either you have to be a Navajo Nation resident or a Navajo Nation employee of some sort can be allowed to access the casino at 25%. All other businesses, youth programs, museums, flea markets, roadside markets, gyms, recreation facilities, and movie theaters are not open yet. But we'll be carefully monitoring a lot of these throughout the next couple of weeks as everyone is going down into a lower lower numbers. We need to keep these down. And that's why we have gating measures.
The tribe will monitor COVID-19, and if trends change, leaders say they'll revisit public health orders. The new orders go into effect on Monday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Chalk it up as yet another casualty of the COVID-19 pandemic. Oregon Parks and Recreation has canceled its 2021 Spring Whale Watch Week program. This means volunteers will not be manning stations at whale watching sites. However, visitors can still enjoy the tradition all on their own. A map of whale watching sites is available on the Oregon State Parks website. About 25,000 gray whales will pass by Oregon's shores from late March to June on their way to Alaskan waters. Many whale calves newly born off the coast of Mexico will make the trip. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 11, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips, 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Nick Campili, and Suzanne Potter. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Native Voice One and Public News Service. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thank you so much for joining us, and stay right here for KBOO News In-Depth coming up next.
KBOO News In-Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Beavers used to be common in what became the United States, yet after hundreds of years of intensive trapping by European colonizers, beavers are much less common in American landscapes. A new bill has been proposed for Oregon's legislature, allowing them to return in greater numbers. My name is Nick Campili, and for the next 15 minutes, I will be speaking with Suzanne Foudy about House Bill 2843 and its importance to the state of Oregon. Suzanne is a retired hydrologist from the U.S. Forestry Service. She received her PhD from the University of Oregon and has spent over 30 years working on water-related issues in the West. She's a co-author for the new bill. Currently, House Bill 2843 is waiting to be scheduled for a hearing and work session by the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. So, you've been interested in water issues in the West for the last 30 years. How are beavers relevant to those studies?
Beavers, when the Europeans arrived, were in the millions. And they influenced every single stream that was out there. And in those streams, they were rich with tons of salmon and wildlife. And they created a very critical mix of habitat types that were actually really resilient to climate variations. So when we took those beavers out, what happened is that the dams began to fall apart. The channels deepened, they widened, and a whole bunch of things began to happen. Water tables dropped. And then on top of that, we have livestock grazing shows up and logging and building of cities and towns and roads. And all of those things sort of set streams on a second path of change. And so the streams we know today are incredibly altered.
Oregon is known as the Beaver State. What role do they play in our environment here in Oregon, and why are they so important?
Right now, what we have is a lot of streams that have stream temperatures that are too high. We have streams that do not have appropriate salmon habitat. We have fish and wildlife habitat that is becoming increasingly fragmented and of poor quality. We have water conflicts rising between farmers and tribes. We have cities worried about whether or not in a drought they're going to have enough drinking water. We have farmers and ranchers who are worried about enough water for their ranches and for their farms. And we have a landscape that is becoming increasingly more fire prone. So what beavers do as they build these dams on streams that are of the right size to build dams, because the dams are the critical feature we're looking for. They create ponds, and those ponds set in motion the ability to have these amazing wetlands. They increase the groundwater stored, they increase surface water, they create complicated riparian habitat in stream and on the valley bottoms. And so when you get a wildfire and the fire meets the beaver dam or the pond or the wetland, all of a sudden water meets fire. And we know how that plays out. Having a beaver wetland or beaver pond, big area, is probably going to make the difference between whether you survive that wildfire or you basically end up as charred flesh. I mean, it's that simple. You are concerned about salmon runs. Beaver habitat is so critical. The habitat that they built is so essential that if you don't have them, you pretty much are saying it's okay if salmon go extinct.
You're advocating for the state legislature to pass House Bill 2843. Why is it important Oregon passes the bill?
Right now, we have a lot of streams in Oregon on federally managed public lands, which is where the bill is focused. And it's focused on federally managed public lands for a couple of really key reasons. They're the size of streams that beavers can build dams on. And the dam building is a critical component of what we're looking for, because it sets everything else in motion as far as habitat recovery. We have a lot of streams on federally managed public lands that are in a damaged state. Stream temperatures are too high. Meadows have converted to dry landscapes. We have lost complicated in-channel habitat. The riparian zones are gone or they're very narrow. And so in order to restore this, we have to restore beavers, because beavers are basically going to be able to build the dams and set in motion all the stream processes that are needed in order to begin to raise the water tables, create wetlands, complicated in-stream habitats that are better for fish, create this really diverse habitat for migratory birds and all kinds of amphibians and reptiles and insects. You can't do it without beavers. You just can't. You need something out there that's going to be out there 24/7, paying attention to the infrastructure, fixing those dams if they get knocked out or damaged by a storm, and maintaining that. You need that on the landscape, and you need it across the landscape. So right now, Oregon has over 23,000 miles of stream that are too warm. That's 23,000 miles of stream in these headwater streams. So imagine what it means if you can get beavers back in, building dams on streams they can, what that means for things like water quality. Right now, beavers can die for a lot of different reasons. They can die from disease. They can die from illegal trapping and hunting. They can die because a tree falls on them. They also die because of legal trapping and hunting. And that is the only cause of death we control. So you can trap and hunt beavers under the current fur bearer regulations from ODF&W from November 15th to March 15th. That is also the breeding season and the pregnancy season. So you can do that. And that's the only one we can control. It turns out that there are studies out there that show if you stop trapping and you give beaver the chance to raise family members, those family members go off and build dams, that you will see beaver dams begin to expand. And as the beaver dams expand, the ponds do, and the wetlands do, and all the habitat does. So it's an attempt to provide protection for beaver on public lands that are the source of our water and have places where you can get this massive improvement in fish and wildlife habitat. If Oregon wants those things, water quality, good fish and wildlife habitat, salmon runs, recovering, then it has to have beavers.
And you've mentioned the effects that passing the bill will have on Oregon's environment. How will House Bill 2843 affect Oregonians?
So it really depends on whether you trap beavers or whether you don't. And it really depends on whether or not you drink water or you don't. So if you trap beavers right now or hunt beavers under the regulations, it is a restriction. You don't get to do that anymore on federally managed public lands. You can still do it on state public lands, and you can still do it on private lands with permission. but you can't do it on federally managed public lands. So right now there are less than 170 people in the entire state that trap and hunt beavers, and the state has over 4.2 million people. So that's the number of people that would no longer be able to do it. So if you are someone, however, who likes to drink water, if you value fish and wildlife habitat, if you're worried about climate change, if you care about salmon runs and really want recovery, if you want to begin to fireproof or alter your landscape so they better deal with fire, if you're worried about making sure farmers and ranchers and cities and towns have water, then it's a huge benefit. And it's a benefit in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So even those individuals who will no longer be able to trap and hunt beavers on federally managed public lands actually stand to benefit enormously.
I don't know if you're the right person to ask this, Suzanne, but it's been mentioned that the bill will help Oregon fulfill its moral and ethical obligations to Oregon's tribes. How does that play in?
Okay, so I am not going to speak for the tribes, but I'm going to speak from the perspective of someone who recognizes that salmon are really important culturally and spiritually to tribal nations, and that salmon are one of their first foods. So from that perspective, that's what I'm going to talk about. When something is that important, you take it seriously. And then I'm going to speak to it from the perspective of being a scientist. So salmon are really important to the tribal nations, spiritually, culturally, and as a first food. Salmon runs, we have 11 stocks that are on the endangered species list. If we want those salmon runs to improve, we have to improve their habitat along the entire length of their life cycle. Beaver dams have been identified as a critical habitat for juvenile coho winter rearing. And the number of ponds, because the number of beaver dams aren't very many, what we have is really limited habitat. So if your juveniles are scrambling, you know, there's just not that much habitat to start with, and that habitat continues to fail, what you have is very limited survival at the beginning stage. If you continue to allow people to trap and hunt beavers, that means that the beavers leave, the dams are left, and they begin to fall apart. When the dams fail, the ponds drain, and the habitat goes away. And so if we are serious and really committed to restoring salmon runs, which is what the Endangered Species Act says we're supposed to be doing, then you have to restore the habitat. You have to protect the habitat. And the habitat for salmon can only be improved and protected if you have a keystone species creating that habitat and maintaining it. So it really boils down to, you can talk about restoring salmon, but if you don't restore the process and the species that we need to help that habitat be recovered, then you're not serious. And so now as I look at salmon and salmon recovery, I feel a lot stronger that this isn't just about the science or the economics. It's about whether or not we honor our commitment to others. And Oregon has laws on the books. It has a lot it has to compensate for. It has a lot to acknowledge and to respond to. And this is a way to say to the tribes, we're serious. We screwed up totally, but we are committed to restoring salmon because it's important to you, because it's important to us, because it's important to countless species.
And you mentioned in our pre-interview correspondence that the bill was facing resistance from Oregon's House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. What is its status right now?
Its status right now is it's waiting to get a hearing, to be scheduled for a hearing, and to be scheduled for a work session. If it isn't scheduled for a hearing and work session by March 19th, the bill dies. It's done. All the benefits that come with it, they're done. There will be no salmon recovery this year. There will be no action that drives salmon recovery. There will be no action that begins to prepare Oregon for wildfire on its landscapes. There will be no action that prepares, that improves streams so drought conditions can be mitigated because stream flows are better. There will be nothing. So right now, the bill is in limbo. By next Friday, it either is scheduled for a hearing and a work session, or it's dead.
And who decides to give the bill a hearing or let it die in committee?
The decision whether or not a bill gets a hearing and is scheduled for a work session rests with the chair of the committee. Right now, House Bill 2843 is in the Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee, and that is chaired by Representative Brad Witt. He decides who gets a hearing and gets scheduled and who does not. And so he's kind of the man of the hour right now. He has a huge ability to make change in terms of Oregon's future. And that's really where we're at. Either he's going to schedule it for a hearing and a work session, and Oregon has a chance of now discussing this bill and potentially actually moving salmon runs and habitat and water issues to the forefront, or he's going to let it die. And that means that those 170 people that trap beaver for fun and a little bit of money will continue to be able to do that. And Oregon will lose hundreds of millions of dollars benefits and services that it desperately needs. And Oregon will continue to play games as it comes to play salmon recovery. So we'll know on March 19th whether or not we have a bill that's been scheduled for hearing and is got a work session, or we're going to know on March 19th if Oregon has just missed another opportunity. And I don't know about you and your listeners, but with climate change, we're running out of opportunities.
And if listeners are interested in learning more about House Bill 2843 and its potential for environmental restoration, what is the best way for them to find out more?
So I would direct them to two different places. The idea of getting a handle on how exciting beaver are and just what they can do, one could go to the Beaver Coalition. It's a new nonprofit, and it is all about information. Information about what beavers do, information about how to solve potential conflicts. It's about helping Oregonians come to know their state beaver. If you're looking for information on the bill, then I would direct you to a couple of websites for a couple of organizations that have come out in support of the bill. The Wetland Conservancy, BARC, Oregon Natural Desert Association. There's 35 groups that have come on, and they range from climate groups to salmon groups to Audubon's to Water Watch. Those groups, Wetland Conservancy, BARC, and Oregon Natural Desert Association websites will have information. And if you're just strictly interested in information, you could still go to those websites, but I would direct you to the Beaver Coalition.
And do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we haven't mentioned yet?
I guess what I would just want to say is sometimes opportunities come along, and this is a citizen-led effort. This is citizens saying, we've got to do something, and we can do something right now at a time when the budget's crashing. We've just come through COVID. Streams are not doing well. Our salmon are dying, and people just don't feel hope. So we are really at a crossroads. A lot of effort's gone into this bill. The science is rock solid. The economics is rock solid. The need is essential, and our responsibility to restoring tribes is without question. It's really about what Representative Brad Witt will choose to do. And then if we get a hearing and a work session, it's about what the state legislature is going to try to do. And that is going to determine Oregon's future.
Great. Thank you so much for speaking with me today, Suzanne. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Nick.
On January 25th, 2021, a driver in a silver Honda Element struck six pedestrians in southeast Portland, killing one. Today, we're speaking with one of the victims who ultimately helped apprehend the driver to understand where the traumatic experience has left him now. Miguel Rochin was one of those hurt in the hit-and-run spree. Miguel was driving when he saw the Element hit a bicyclist.
I saw he's jumping, you know. I can say 50%, you know. I don't know, I don't really make sure whether he hit, you know. After that, I can say 100% when he hit in about 18 in Stark Avenue, he hit a bicycle, you know. The guy, you know, was on it. So when the bike disappeared with his hands. And then I just did, you know, pull over my car, you know, to try to help the people, you know. But besides, you know, a lady with El Camino, like in 1980s, you know, classic, the black color, was in front of me. She's parked, you know, I'm parked, I'm back, and she's back, back, you know. And then I'm asking her what's going on. But we and then try to ask into the people if everybody's right, you know. She need help, you know. I was screaming, but nobody mean say nothing. It's because the guys, I think so. When they hit something, return a little bit back, you know. When he's passing 18, he hit the guy, you know, and then he drove his car, you know, Honda Element. by the sidewalk next to the school, you know. And then the sidewalk, and then he's turning 17. And then he's turning back to 19. I was in the middle of that thing. And where I saw him, the guy driving back, you know, straight to me.
He recorded the driver with his phone, but the driver turned around and began accelerating towards him. Miguel tried to jump out of the way, but was clipped by the car bumper, injuring his leg and his hand.
And then I just using my phone, you know, to say, I tried to avoid him, you know, like it's a weapon, you know. He said, you can't do that nothing to me because I got you on camera, you know. But this guy, I mean, I see his face, you know, like an evil face, like a Chucky the doll, you know, like this evil laugh, and came straight to me and gave more gas to his car. Say for that moment, I said, oh my God, you know, what are you gonna do, you know? And then I'm gonna choose, you know, the video of my life, you know, what I mean, I put my phone away, you know, and drop it, and then he's, trying to hit me, I go all squish all the way to my bed, you know, because I was already outside my bed, started helping people who was an injury, but that guy, and then he's passed me, you know, and ended up one of my pants, you know, and I hit my hand, because he's got like on the right side, he's got like a black bumper hanging, you know, with a smack, you know, with a bumper.
Miguel chased the car down the road, and as it wrecked into another car, he chased the driver who had hit all those people. He says he wasn't thinking about himself in that moment, but the school nearby.
He's jumping from his car. I decided to chase him, you know, because I think this guy's going to kill some kids in the school, you know, or whatever, you know, or any person. And then I decided to chase him because he's jumping from his car. Well, his car, you know, when he already he can't go anywhere, he tried to make reverse, but the car was stuck on it. And then he's run all the way, going to the start to 17, and turned left, going to Belmont, and I chasing him, you know. And then when I go with him, you know, he started to punch me twice on my face, and I said, go on the ground. I mean, he said, I was surprised he did it one time, you know. And the second time, I mean, the people came over, you know, three guys, we corralled him, you know. But I was, I mean, and then whether he came over to me and I tried to go in his pocket, you know, and jacket and grab something white, I don't know, I can say like a piece of bread, or I don't know if it was drug, and throw him in my face, you know. And then after that, you know, I was waiting for the police, you know, they came over, you know. After the cops, police came over, you know, and take care of the situation, you know. That's what I can say about that day, you know. I mean, what's it? My point, you know, I saw a school, you know, with the kids, I mean, the playground, you know. I don't want to hurt kids, you know. I mean, I got family values, you know, and then we always take care of the kids, you know. I mean, and then that's what I try to do, you know, put them safe, you know, don't hurt any kids, you know, any children. Besides, you know, I don't expect that he's already killed that lady. My point is to rescue people. I don't want to be the victim, you know. And now I'm turning to the victim and the captor of that guy, you know, pretty much because I mean, furious, you know, and he was, I mean, just run over people, you know, like a crazy. I don't know what's going on.
This isn't the first traumatic incident that Miguel has endured in recent memory either. Miguel was present on the MAX train in 2017 during the fatal stabbings. Miguel is also an undocumented day laborer, which means his injuries have had a major impact on his ability to support himself financially.
And then I'm a laborer, day worker, you know. I went to tried to talk to boss, you know, a couple of days ago, I think so last week, if I can have any help, you know, like I need assistance, you know, for program, you know, for mental health, and then I need to recovery for this thing, you know, my hands, you know. It's I'm still using physical therapy, and then until today. But I mean, I need to get some. I got dreams, you know, and then I don't want to depress, you know. Depressed, you know. Actually, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm doing my program, you know. I don't want to relapse, you know. I'm sober now, you know. But I think because besides, I already wasn't not a crime, you know, for that MAX station back on 3 years ago. I saw the people died there. It means two times, you know, I wasn't in this kind of crime, you know.
Christian Salgado is a friend of Miguel's. They met while Christian was the director of the Voz Workers' Rights Education Project Workers' Center on MLK.
It's a day labor workers' center. If you're not familiar with it, or if anybody listening is not familiar with it, it's a place where, you know, day laborers go and get connected to work in a safe manner, and also have different kind of educational and workforce development opportunities, different sorts of education. So, you know, like know your rights, labor laws, and, you know, when their right is to get paid, and help them with any issues with wage theft. And so the majority of them, I think when we were there, we surveyed, there was about 75% to 80% of them were homeless. So either living on the street or staying in a shelter. And I believe Miguel was one of these day laborers that, you know, was kind of bouncing around. And so the nature of the day labor work is that, you know, their pay's not guaranteed from week to week. It's like a day-to-day thing, and it's not guaranteed that they find work every day. And in those kind of environments, if you have an injury, or if you have a day where you can't go to work, like, the next person takes your job, right? So it's really important so there's no, like, safety there in job security. And so it's really important for workers like this to really show up to their work so they can keep getting hired. And so any sort of, like, injury or thing that would limit somebody's capacity kind of puts them at risk for losing work, just because there's so many folks out there looking for work in this manner. And so I left the job there in 2018. I currently work for Portland General Electric, and Miguel reached out to me after this occurred because, you know, understandably, he experienced a traumatic event. So he was dealing with a lot of, you know, not knowing what to do or how to handle it, and not knowing where his next paycheck was going to come from, because, you know, he wasn't going to be able to work. And then on top of that, he made a mention of this. He actually was on the MAX when the attacks happened. I don't know if you remember when that person attacked the two women of color on the MAX, and, you know, a few people in there. So he was actually on the MAX, and he witnessed that also. So that's two major events in Portland where people ended up getting, you know, murdered. And so he's just experienced a lot of trauma, honestly. And I'm helping him out in the hopes that, you know, he can find the resources that he needs to really find some healing, have a chance to really step back and get the help he needs. He's doing the right things. I mean, he's advocating for himself. That's one of the great things about Miguel. He knows that where to go to get help. And so, you know, for folks that are listening, Miguel won't say this because he doesn't like asking for help, but please, you know, if you can, just donate to his GoFundMe so we can get him some breathing room, so he can really just take the time he needs to really just work on recovering from this. I know it's really hard for him to keep repeating the story and talking about it. And so, yeah, if there's just anybody listening who can help, just donate to him and, you know, and help him find some breathing room.
For Miguel, the reason he wants people to hear his story isn't because he wants to be considered a hero.
I don't like doing common hero. No, I'm not a hero. I think it's too big, you know, for me. I just try to help, you know, people. You know, I've been doing it. You know, my father was for the fire department volunteer in my country, and then we already have it. You know, my genes, you know, help people.
The one thing that Miguel wanted to reach out to me for was not because he wanted money or he wanted help or anything else. What he really had in mind was, Mexican immigrants get a lot of negative press, and there's a lot of negative attention and association, right? With the past administration, I mean, Trump got like 75 million votes or something. So there's a lot of sentiment out there about, you know, the negative kind of connotations with immigrants. And so Miguel was like, hey, you know, I've been a part of both these things, and this time I actually, like, stepped up and put my life at risk to stop an event. And I really want to get this out there to show that we're not just here, you know, to do all these negative things that people think we're here to do, that we're actually members of the community who are willing to step up when it's needed to support other people. So I think that's really commendable, and I just wanted to highlight that as we're talking, that when he reached out, that was his concern, is like, hey, no, we need to show that we're here and we're part of the community and we're doing great things. But in the midst of all those conversations, I was like, man, Miguel, it's okay to ask for help. And also just, keeping in mind that we do have a lot of people with Miguel's background that live in our community, and they're really great assets and attributes to our community. And we really should be working on reducing or getting rid of those negative kind of lenses we see our community through.
I mean, keeping doing the best for our community, you know? And if I'm gonna end up losing my life, try to helping people, that's my destiny, I will keep it, helping people, if I see any situation.
We heard from Miguel Rochin, who was hit in the January 25th hit and run spree in Southeast Portland, and Christian Salgado, a friend of Miguel's and the former director of the Vaz Workers Center on Martin Luther King. More information on this story can be found on our website, kboo.fm. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO is hiring a membership director. Our membership director maintains relationships with KBOO members and listeners, create a process to meet or exceed fundraising goals, and manage the membership database. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit kboo.fm/employment. Apply by March 15th.